My guest on Dan Really Likes Wine this week is the definitive old school wine personality, a man famously described by Adi Badenhorst as the one person you want to know who can wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning to fix a pike and then get out and make some wine just hours later. He's the man behind the 100 Point Porcelainburg, but he's a hunter and a farmer as much as he's a winemaker. Cully, lovely to have you on the show.
How's it, Dan? Lucky to be here.
I was thinking back to Ellen, we've discussed this a few times, but that very first time that we met when you were in absolute bliss, you had your smoker at Martin Tucker's Cape Town Festival of Beer. Yeah. You'd had a joint of meat, which I think you'd hunted yourself, which you'd been cooking for days at least. You had a couple of cold beers in hand, and winemakers do like their beer. And that was just kind of the definitive Cully, smoking some meat, having a beer and enjoying some good time and some mates.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I think I was happier about being there than for the beer than anything else. I'm a big fan of the beer.
And that's true of many winemakers. In fact, whenever I have a winemaker on for dinner or for a bride, the first thing they ask for is a beer, which I suppose makes sense because you do spend so much time producing and living with and making and then involved with wine. How did that journey start for you? When did a kid from the Free State decide that wine might be the way to go?
Well, I grew up in a restaurant, so we always had wine in the house, but it was never really, you know, my parents weren't seeking out the best bottles. They were drinking what most people were drinking those days. Longer Sauvignon Blanc was like a big treat those days. And I wanted to study medicine, and I was in a residence that was pretty known for the party vibes, Simonsberg, and yeah, it turned out that I was more interested in the party times than really studying. And I really like farming. So I'd been working on a massive vegetable farm in the Free State most holidays when I could get a chance and not waiting tables. I'd be on a tractor. And when I sort of realized that medicine wasn't going to be my way to a scratch or a slice of Saskia Sam, and my dad and myself were driving, I thought we were on the way to Klangmont, and we drove past the last place, I think it's Wildekrans on the left, and he said to me, what about winemaking? And it was sort of, yeah, maybe let's give that a go.
I'm very glad that you did, because I'm sure you would have been a very good doctor, and your wine has made me feel a lot better on many occasions, admittedly slightly worse the day after, but finding your way into wine is a very happy, happy occasion. And finding your way into Porcelainburg, as you are now, even more so. But what was the journey from deciding to study wine to finding your way into the industry?
So the normal way to do it is to study. We studied, just a BA, BSc, sorry, at uni at Stellenbosch. And you normally then, after graduation, find you don't normally just walk into or get a winemaking position. You'll first be an assistant, and you normally wait for that winemaker to die or leave, and then you'll get his job. So that's a pretty standard way. And I never really wanted to do that. So I spent some years overseas, traveled to France, Australia, New Zealand, and a couple of times to America, where I actually worked with Andrea at Cakewood Cellars, and came back. And funneling was my first sort of real job. And I was there for a couple of years. And then Chris and Andrea moved to do their own thing in 2007. And then I took over at TMV. And that's also sort of the time of my life when I started getting really interested in organics and sustainability and more on the farming side as opposed to the cellar work. Because I worked for a guy in the south of France, Gerard Gobi. And that's where it sort of all just manifested in my brain that you need to farm grapes to make red wine and not the other way around, you know. And good things happen in cellars, but the ultimate thing is in the 11 months before the grapes are picked. I think that's the important time, not the 2 weeks you get to work with the grapes. And yeah, when the Molyneux moved, I moved in there, and Mark and myself, I met Mark for the first time in 2007, I think, or 2008, Mark from Buchenholz, and we were standing next to each other. And those wine shows are not my favorite. It's not, you know, talk not wine. I like to drink wine, and I like to show people, you know, on the farm things. But standing in a foreign place, especially a place like the UK, is difficult for me. Anyway, so we met there, And in 2009, Buchanan's Kloof bought the property, and he called me and asked me if I wanted to come farm, and it was a pretty easy yes.
You're such a quintessentially South African figure. You love the land. You love being on your farm. You're a very simple guy in terms of the taste and what makes you happy. And I think that's what so many of us love about you. And yet you've also had so much time, as you say, in France, in America, in New Zealand. How did that part, those travels, feed into creating who Kali the winemaker, Kali the farmer is today?
I think for me, I'm a very inquisitive taster. I like tastes, and it's just nice to see how things happen in other countries. I think it's good to see how people work, just learning work ethic, learning to do stuff yourself, and just having a look at, some places when you start sending out CVs for like harvest works, everybody really wants to go and work at the best places. So I did the same thing. So you send your CVs to the Moutons, and you send your CVs to Screaming Eagle. And something I found out, I did go and work for one or two really cool places, really well-known places. But you learn a few things, but you don't really learn things because those places are so set in their ways. You just become a little gear. And I worked at some really shitty places, and I learned the most there because they do a lot of stuff wrong. And there's a, yeah, so you learn how to do things and you learn how not to do things. And I think real experience has been learning how not to do things, and come back with, a bit more of a clearer idea of what to do. And working for people that's really inspirational, where they really focus on the farming side of it, really focus on working with the land and not interfering too much in the winery, and having the confidence for the grapes to do the talking. I think those are the things that sort of stuck with me. And working three vintages with Artie set that all up as well.
Well, we all have our crosses to bear over our careers. It broadened your horizon, certainly, but it did not change one iota the fundamental Kali. And for people who don't know you, in order to set up this particular conversation, I actually had to post you a note, which I did last year, and we've finally been able to get you in. I think you do reluctantly have a mobile phone, but it's a Nokia 3310 that you can play Snake on. You've got just this wonderfully, to borrow from Niels Faaborg, Luddite approach to things, where it's very hands-on, it's very simplified, it is very old school, but it's not kind of hipster old school. It's not put on for show. This genuinely is who you are, how you approach things, how your philosophy around wine and by extension life works.
Yeah, I have unfortunately upgraded to something that's got WhatsApp, but I must admit,
Shockwaves through the wine industry.
that's easy. It's a phenomenal tool to be able to send my Sparky or somebody in the irrigation, just a photo of a broken pipe, and makes life quite a bit easier. But anyway, yeah, I like the simple things. The sort of the farming, just the way I like to do things. I like to weld, I like to grind, I like to build stuff. They're not never the squarest or the prettiest, but they're practical. So for me, aesthetics has never been my drive. Practicality is what I live for.
And it goes back to what you said a little bit earlier about being a farmer rather than a winemaker. Now, there are many people led by the likes of Tim Atkin who would probably argue otherwise because they've tasted your wine and been blown away by it. But you're right, it is a few weeks in the cellar where the wine process takes place. The rest of the year, you're not putting your feet up and living the Duncan Savage life of going surfing around the world at vast expense every week. You're out there, you're working the land, you're getting your hands dirty, partly because that's how you feel it should work, but also because you do get immense enjoyment out of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it is, I'd like to be Duncan surfing.
Oh, we'd all like to be Duncan.
But I think just being in the vineyard, not necessarily even working, I think is also where it's at. To really understand a place, you have to be there. When the winds change, not to spray. When it's just small things that you learn, and that's just from time on one place. You're not everywhere. You wake up every morning in the same vineyard. And for me, this is basically the only way to really get to know a place, and ultimately to you know, finify the grapes to the best possible or the clearest. I don't think making great wine or making the best wine, I don't think was ever for me like a goal. It was just for me like trying to express the place and the vintage the best way possible.
Well, if making the best wine was accidental, then it was a very happy accident, because the Porcelainburg Syrah has become this must-have South African icon wine. And in particular, after the world discovered that we had a 100-point wine in our midst, you're not somebody who gets terribly excited and carried away by things other than the opportunity to go hunting. But when that news broke, when you found out, what was your response to going, hey, I've got a wine and a top international wine critic says it could not be better?
Yeah, I think it is a massive shock, eh? It felt good quite a few days later because, yeah, sometimes you don't really believe that, I suppose, you with it or something like that. But yeah, it was amazing. It was really cool. Yeah, I suppose one of those things, eh?
No one does understatement like Cully. Was it a wine when you made it, when you first took it out of barrel, once it had a bit of time to find its feet and develop a bit of its character, that you felt had something special to it?
Well, it was the first year that I was using the submerged caps. So the years previous, we did just the conventional fermentation with pump overs. I use whole bunches. And the one thing with whole bunches is the porous cap. And I used a few different things to make that better because we had some fruit flies on the top of the cap. And I visited a friend working at Domaine Jamay, which is a really cool Cotroti producer, one of the few left that still use 100% whole bunches, and they use the submerged cap. And I basically came back with that idea to get rid of my fruit flies. And I started to build in, and I really liked what, you know, we had to do a lot less pump overs. We could drink one, two more beers. So I used that for the 2018 vintage, and the wine definitely tasted slight bit different, but there was something, you know. For me, every vintage is its own wine. I don't think it's very difficult. Obviously, you have favorites from time to time, but it's for me, everyone's got a story. And every now and again, you want to go and have a look at that story again. It's not something that you can get enough of. But 2018 was definitely, for me, a shift into a positive. There were some things in the wine that I look for that look better. So we're still using the submerged caps. We still have no fruit flies and we still drink more beer.
You set out to get rid of fruit flies and drink beer and you ended up with 100-point wine. I think that's a fabulous, fabulous result. One last piece to that broader wine story and the famous printing press at Porcelainburg. Most, if not all, other wineries in the country have got these high-tech, high-speed labeling processes. And in seconds, you've got thousands of bottles labeled. Yours is a little bit different.
Yeah, so we had the label designed by a young squad in 2010 already, Fanigolo. And the whole look and feel and drive behind the Porcelainburg was the sort of Delft tile kind of thing, and then obviously all the textures and all that. And with the new makings of labels, I don't know too much of them because I've only worked on Heidelberg, but I think you get stuff like Eyebold and it's all kinds of matte glosses and what. So the only way to achieve what the label is on a Heidelberg. They're the only ones that can still do that really deep embossing and you get all that texture. And we were blown away by these guys there, by the presentation. And yeah, I think it was somewhere in 2010, Mark called me and he's like, oh, you won't, it was a Tuesday, just can't remember which month. But anyway, you won't believe what I bought you. And I was like, hoping for another tractor. And it was the Heidelberg. So I had this Heidelberg, it was in my office since 2010. And then early, I think it was June of 2012, because we would have released it 2010 then. We got a guy that has been working on these things forever. Hallmark Press is the people that still do a lot of labels for people. I think they pivot to Hallmark. Anyways, so Prince came over to show me the ropes. And it's quite funny, this printing press is this big flywheel. And I turned it on and he's like, oh, that thing shouldn't turn. So I'm reasonably, my brain is a bit practical, and I sort of looked at the drive, the fan belt and the motor, and it's like, my man, this is the only thing that should turn. Anyways, we later worked it out that he's discovered. So in 25 years of working with the letterpress, he's never seen the big flywheel turn, but it was turning under that cover. But yeah, so that was it, eh? And it was a hobby and it was fun then. And it was 3,000 bottles, and it's a bit more of a graft now at about 60,000 bottles.
But you still do all of that by hand?
Every single one.
That's incredible. Tell me a little bit more about this relationship with Mark Cadd, because it started off as a, would you like to come and work with me? I would assume it's become a little more than that since then.
Yeah, I think the big strength is of Mark and especially Bhupinder Sklerf is they back the people that work for them, and they don't interfere unless obviously something goes wrong. But they believe in their people, and they back the gears inside the machine there. And just, yeah, I think in terms of what he's achieved in wine and with everything, I mean, I think the proudest thing for me is growing most of the grapes of the chocolate block, because this is the wine that's in most homes in the world. Porsche is a little drop in the bucket, but the chocolate block making volume for me is a much bigger achievement than making 5 bottles.
And that is, it is well worth bringing up, because the sheer amount of chocolate block that is now produced, when you get to those sorts of volumes, maintaining the quality that you do for what has now become probably the wine most people outside of South Africa tell me about when I ask them about South African wine. Yes, there's an element in which the marketing has been a triumph, and that is something that Mark is well acquainted with, but your marketing can only go so far. There has to be something to back it up, and you have something to back it up.
Yeah, no, I think, and especially, we started Post Lemberg as a grape source for the Bhupinder Sklerf Syrah. It was never supposed to go any further than that. We just decided to keep the first vintage of grapes on the farm. There's a hill cellar. Post Lemberg was born, and then we acquired more land and 2 more farms. And from what was supposed to be about 300 tons of grapes is now just north of 1,000. And it's all farmed organic and regenerative. So I think from that point, being in control and being owning your own grape source, I think is more valuable than most people think. Yeah.
All of those elements combined make you a figure who's inspired many in South Africa, both those of us who get to drink your wine, but also other winemakers, wine producers who see what you do and how you've done it. And you've given us a great example in so many ways. There are people who've done that to you and wines who've done that to you. And I asked you to bring along some wine to share. You've gone slightly differently, not unusual, the unorthodox Cully. So we're making do with some of that Badenhorst rubbish instead. But you've got 2 bottles here, which you very unkindly finished yourself before you arrived, that both of them speak to both vintage and to provenance. Let's start with the little one in front of me. If you're listening to this, it's a half bottle of 1970 Chateau Libertas. I haven't had the 70, but I've had a number from slightly later in the 70s, and I've had them in the last year or two. Every single one of them has blown me away.
Yeah, I think the brief was bring one of your own bottles, and I definitely didn't want to do that, and or something inspirational. And I don't think a full bottle of wine can be inspirational because you haven't drunk it, so I pulled 2 off my shelf there. The 1970 Chateau Lib, I bought this because this is, strangely enough, probably of any wine in my life I've had the most of. I bought the first full case from Wine Cellar in about 2014. I paid R200 a bottle, and I finished every bottle in the same year. And since then, it's a wine that's just popped up. You know, this was the last bottle I had. A friend of mine actually bought a whole pile in at the old Joburg auction house or something. So yeah, I've still got some. I'll get a bottle. I just didn't have one now, otherwise I would have bought it. But we'll have one together. I think just in terms of South Africa, and I think what, you know, this is wines that the world should be tasting. And this is a run-of-the-mill wine. You know, it is a more or less an entry-level wine, and I've been having it since it was 40-something years old until now, past 50. And as you said, not one bottle. I have not put one down the drain.
It's extraordinary how marketing can shape wine, in that you can get away with wine to a reasonable degree, but it ultimately has to be something great. But wine doesn't always get to where it might without the right story or marketing. And for many people today, Chateau Libertas is a kind of bottom to middle of the shelf. It's not held in the esteem that perhaps it should. And you wonder if Mark Kent was running Chateau Libertas in the 1970s, would this now be a 1,000, 1,500 rand a bottle of wine, because it's got that quality and it's got that history.
Yeah, no, I think definitely. I think back then I wasn't born then, but I don't know if, maybe the sort of the long-term goals were just a bit different then, but I think, just from a wine's point of view, this is just before I think they started, messing around a bit with acid additions and things like that, to still grapes in more or less old barrels or tanks. And so pure wine.
1970. Then next to it, 1973, and that is some Canon Corp, a very different label to the one we see today. That must have been just about the first wine they ever produced.
Yeah. So this is actually quite a nice story. We had a guy from America, one of the wine magazines, wine sensationalist, enthusiast, whatever. And we actually had this next door on the Rivex Rivier farm, Bay and Linton and Evan and a few of the boys. It was, I think, the beginning of the big noise about old vineyards, and everybody was, there's still quite a bit of noise about old vineyards. But I was in a massive planting phase, and I was just irritated by all this old vineyard noise, because you need to plant vineyards to get them old. And I think sometimes we're making less noise about planting vineyards and just carrying on about the old things. And I do definitely believe there's a lot of merit in old vineyards. Make nice balanced grapes and everything, but we still need to plant some younger vineyards. Anyways, so this was the only bottle I had of this, and I don't think there's a hell of a lot of them left. And I poured this, pulled it blind, and just for this oak to have a taste, and all of us tasted, and that was actually a sensational bottle.
What did your wine critic sensation place it as? Did he have a clue?
No. So I said to him, do you think this is from old vineyards? And he said, no, definitely. I said, bullshit. It's from the first crop, Cabernet Vineyard, and I think Jan Bullen still thinks it's maybe one of the best wines he's made in his life. I think wines need to be judged on what they taste like and not what the story on the tasting sheet tells you. So I like things like that.
It's the Dan really likes wine mantra. Good wines when you like and bad wines when you don't.
Yes, exactly.
I think that's one I rather would have liked. Two wonderful stories of two wonderful wines, which is appropriate for somebody who's created such a wonderful wine story. And amazingly so, yes, there's the wine that goes into the chocolate block, but we see you first and foremost as the man behind the Porcelainburg, who makes just one wine, but gee, is it a great one. It was such a wonderful wine story on Dan Really Likes Wine this week, Cully Learn.